I've always personally believed that the film does exist, not personally out of just a unfounded fanboy wish, but just based on the evidence and examples of other films that have been found throughout time. But at one point there was nothing on London After Midnight, and now there is just short of 20 frames for the film. So I do believe it does exist, but I think it's lost until found, personally.
Lost Until Found. That should be the title of this episode. That was film historian Daniel Titley talking about one of the most famous and infamous lost films of all time, Lon Chaney's London After Midnight. Hello, and welcome to episode 120 of the Occasional Film Podcast, the occasional companion podcast to the Fast Cheap Movie Thoughts blog. I'm the blog's editor, John Gaspard. In today's episode, we'll chat with Daniel about London After Midnight and the interesting facts and theories he's uncovered and debunked during the writing of his terrific book on that lost film, a film that's actually been part of his life since his childhood. So, Daniel, when did you first become aware of London After Midnight?
I was about 7 years old when I first stumbled into Lon Chaney through my love of all things Universal horror and that whole plethora of characters and actors that you just knew by name but hadn't necessarily seen, away from the many still photographs of Frankenstein, Dracula, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And The Phantom was the one to really spark my interest. But this was prior to eBay. I couldn't see the film of Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera for years, so I kind of had the ultimate buildup of books and documentaries just teasing me all the time. And when I eventually did watch a few documentaries, the one thing that they all had in common was the name Lon Chaney. And I just thought, I need to learn more about this character, Lon Chaney, because he just sounds someone of superhuman proportions, just to have done all of these crazy, diverse characters. And that's where London After Midnight eventually peeked out at me and occupied a separate interest, as all the Chaney characterizations do.
So how did you get into the Universal Films? Were you watching them on VHS? Were they on TV? The DVDs happened by then?
I was still in the VHS days. My dad is a real big fan of all this as well. So he first saw Bela Lugosi's Dracula on TV when he was a kid. And prior to me being born, he had amassed a huge VHS collection. And a lot of those had Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Henry Hall, Claude Rains, Vincent Price, what have you. And a lot of them were dedicated to Universal horror. And as a young, curious kid, my eyes eventually crossed these beautiful cases and I really wanted to watch them. I think my first one I ever watched was the Mummy's Tomb, or Curse of the Mummy, and it's just been growing ever since, really.
You're starting at the lesser end of the Universal monsters. It's like someone starting the Marx Brothers at the big store and going, oh, these are great. I wonder if there's anything better.
Well, I kind of like the fact that you have come by this fascination honestly, as my father would say. You sort of inherited the family business, if you will. The book is great. The book is just great. And I'll be honest, I had no, except for recording the novel that John wrote, I really had no frame of reference for London After Midnight.
Well, Jim, were you a monster guy? Were you a Universal monster kid?
I mean, I had all the models. I love all of that. And I certainly knew about Lon Chaney as Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame. I knew he was the man with a thousand faces. I knew when he died, he wrote J.R. on his makeup kit and gave it to his kid. So I knew stuff. But London After Midnight, I didn't know at all, except for the sort of iconic makeup and that image, which I was familiar with. What was the inspiration for you in terms of writing this book?
Well, like you say, I really had no immediate go-to reference for London After Midnight, away from one or two images in a book. Really, clearly, they were very impactful images of Chaney skulking around the old haunted mansion with Edna Titchener by his side with the lantern. The eyes, the teeth, the cloak, the the top hat, the webs, everything, pretty much everything that embodies a good atmospheric horror movie. But obviously we couldn't see it. So that is all. Its fangs had deepened itself into my bloodstream at that point. Just like, why is it lost? Why can't I see it? And again, the term lost film was an alien concept to me at a young age. I've always been a very curious child. Anything that I don't know or understand that much, even things I do understand that well, I always have to try to find out more because I just can't accept that it's like a bookend process. It begins and then it ends. And that was the thing with London After Midnight. Everything I found in books or in little interviews, they were just all a bit too brief. And I just thought there has to be a deeper history here, as there are with many of the greatest movies of all time. But same with the movies that are more obscure. There is a full history there somewhere because a film takes months to a year to complete. It was definitely a good challenge for me. When we first had our first home computer, it was one of those very few early subjects I was typing in like crazy to try to find out everything that I could. And that all incubated in my little filing cabinet, which I was able to call upon years later. Some things which were redundant, some things which I had the only links to that I had printed off in advance, quite sensibly so. But then there were certain things that just had lots of question marks to me. What year did the film perish? How did it perish? The people who saw the film originally. And unlike a lot of Chinese films, which have been covered in immense detail, London After Midnight, considering it's the most famous of all lost films, still for me had major holes in it that I just really wanted to know the answers to. A lot of those answers eventually, I found even people who knew and institutions that knew information to key events like the famous MGM fire, they were hard-pressed to connect anything up in regards to the film. It was like a jigsaw puzzle. I had all these amazing facts. However, none of them kind of made sense with each other. My favorite thing is researching and finding the outcomes to these things. So that's originally what spiraled me into the storm of crafting this initial dissertation that I set myself, which eventually became so large I had to do it as a book. Despite I'd always wanted to do a book as a kid, when you see people that you idolize, for some reason you just want to write a book on them, despite there had been several books on Lon Chaney. But I just always knew from a childhood that I always wanted to contribute a printed volume, either on Chaney or a particular film. And London After Midnight seemed to present the opportunity to me. I really just didn't want it to be a rehash of everything that we had seen before or read before in other accounts or in the famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, but just with a new cover. So I thought I would only do a book if I could really contribute a fresh new perspective on the subject, which I hopefully did.
Oh, yeah, you absolutely did. And this is an exhaustive book and a little exhausting. There's a ton of stuff in here. You mentioned Famous Monsters of the Filmland, which is where I first saw that image. There's at least one cover of the magazine that used that image. And Forry Ackerman had some good photos and would use them whenever he could. And also would compare them to Mark of the Vampire, the remake, partially because I think Carol Borland was still alive and he could interview her. And he talked about that remake quite a bit. But that iconic image that he put on the cover and whenever he could in the magazine, Jim and I were talking before you came on, Daniel, about, in my mind, when you think of Lon Chaney, there's three images that come to mind: Phantom of the Opera, Quasimodo, and this one. And I think this one, the man in the beaver hat, probably is the most iconic of his makeups because it is. It somehow it got adopted into the culture as this is what you go to when it's a creepy guy walking around. And that's the one that everyone remembers. Do you have any idea specifically what his process was for making that look? Because it is, I think, ultimately a fairly simple design. It's just really clever.
Yes, it probably does fall into the category of his more simplistic makeup. But again, Lon Chaney did a lot of things simplistic today were never seen back then in, say, 1927, particularly in Phantom of the Opera's case in 1925. in which a lot of that makeup today would be done through CG in terms of trying to eliminate the nose or to make your lips move to express dialogue. Chaney was very fortunate to have lived in the pantomime era where he didn't have to rely on how his voice would sound trying to talk through the dentures, in which case the makeup would probably have to have been more tamed to allow audio recorded dialogue to properly come through. But with regards to Beaver Hat makeup, he had like thin wires that fitted around his eyes to give it a more hypnotic stare. The teeth, which he had constructed by a personal dentist, eventually had a wire attached to the very top that held the corners of his mouth open into a nice curved, fixated, almost Joker-like grin. You can imagine with the monocles around his eyes, he thankfully there probably wasn't that much wind on a closed set, so because he probably couldn't have closed his eyes that many times. But a lot of these things become spoken about and detailed over time with the mythic status that he had to have his eyes operated on to achieve the constant widening of his eyelids, or the teeth. He could only wear the teeth for certain periods of time before accidentally biting his tongue or his lips, etc. But Chaney certainly wasn't a sadist with himself, with his makeups. He was very professional, although he did go through undoubtedly a lot of discomfort, especially probably the most explicit case would be for the Hunchback of Notre Dame, in which his whole body is crooked down into a stooped position. But with London After Midnight, I do highly suspect that the inspiration for that makeup in general came from the Dracula novel. And because MGM had not acquired the rights to the Dracula novel, unlike how Universal acquired the rights to the Hunchback, or more importantly, Phantom of the Opera, by which point Gaston Leroux was still alive, it was just a loose adaptation of Dracula. But nevertheless, when you read the description of Dracula in Bram Stoker's novel, he does bear a similarity to Chaney's vampire, in which it's the long hair, a mouth full of sharp teeth, a ghastly pale pallor, and just dressed all in black and carries around a lantern. Whereas the Bela Lugosi takes extraordinary leaps and bounds away from the Stoker novel. But it must have definitely had an impact at the time, enough for MGM to overmarket the image of Chaney's vampire, which only appears in the film for probably just under 4 minutes compared to his detective disguise, which is the real main character of the film. Although the thing we all want to see is Chaney moving about as the vampire and what facial expressions he pulled. It's just something that we just want to see because it's Lon Chaney.
Right, and it makes you wonder if he had lived and had gotten to play Dracula, he kind of boxed himself into a corner then. If he'd already used the look from the book, you wonder what he would have come up with if Lugosi hadn't done it and if Chaney had been our first Dracula.
You know, the other thing that I think of strictly like through my actor filter is, here's a guy who, take Hunchback or Phantom or even this thing, whatever process he went through to put that makeup on, you know, was hours of work, I'm sure. Hunchback, several hours of work to get to that he did himself, and then they'd film all day. So on top of, I mean, I just think that that's like, wow, when you think about today, where somebody might go into a makeup chair and have two or three people working on them to get the look they want, even if it took a few hours, that person is just sitting there getting the makeup done. He's doing all of this and then turns in a full day in front of the cameras, which to me is like, wow, that's incredible.
Definitely. It's like two jobs in one. I imagine for an actor, it must be really grueling in adapting to a makeup, especially if it's a heavy makeup where it covers the whole of your head or crushes down your nose, changes your lips, the fumes of chemicals going into your eyes. But then by the end of it, I imagine you are quite exhausted from just your head adapting to that. But then you have to go out and act as well. With right. Jamie, I suppose he could be more of a perfectionist and take as much time as he wanted within reason. And then once he came to the grueling end of it all, he's actually got to go out and act countless takes and probably repair a lot of the makeup as well after a couple of takes, certainly with things like The Hunchback or The Phantom of the Opera.
And, you know, it's not only is he doing the makeup and acting, but in, you know, not so much in London After Midnight, but in Phantom of the Opera, he is quite athletic. When the Phantom moves, he really moves. He's not stooped. He's got a lot of energy to him. And he's got a makeup on that, unlike the Quasimodo makeup, what he's attempting to do with a Phantom is reductive. He's trying to take things away from his face. Mm-hmm. And he's using all the tricks he knows and lighting to make that happen. But that means he's got to hit particular marks for the light to hit it just right and for you to see that his face is as, you know, skull-like as he made it. When you see him, you know, in London After Midnight as the Professor Inspector character, he's got a normal full man's face. It's a real face, much like his son. He had a kind of a full face. And what he was able to do with the Phantom and take all that away and be as physical as he was is just phenomenal. I mean, he was a really, besides the makeup, he was a really good actor.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I kind of, in what I watched, I wonder if he was the makeup artist, but not the actor, and he did exactly the same makeup on somebody else, and so we had the same image, if those things would have resonated with us the way they do today. I think it had everything to do with who he was and his abilities, in addition to the incredible makeup. He was just a tremendous performer.
Absolutely. He was a true multitasker. In his early days of theater, he was not only an actor, but he was a choreographer. He had a lot of jobs behind the scenes as well. Even when he had become a star in his own time, he would still help actors find the character within them, like Norma Shearer, etc. People who were kind of new to the movie making scene, and the directors didn't really have that much patience with young actors or actresses. Whereas Chaney, because of his clout in the industry, no one really interfered with Chaney's authority on set, but he would really help actors find the character, find the emotion, because it was just all about how well you translate it over for the audience, as opposed to the actor feeling a certain way that convinces themselves that they're the character. Chaney always tried to get the emotions across to the audience. Patsy Ruth Miller, who played Esmeralda in The Hunchback, said that Chaney directed the film probably more than the director actually did. The director was actually even suggested by Chaney. So Chaney really had his hands everywhere in the making of a film. And Patsy Ruth Miller said the thing that she learned from him was that it's the actor's job to make the audience feel how the character's meant to be feeling, and not necessarily the actor to feel what they should be feeling based on the script and the settings and everything. So I think that's why Chaney in particular stands out from all of the actors of his time.
Yeah, I think he would have transitioned really well into sound. I think he had everything necessary to make that transition.
There's one sound picture with him in it, isn't there? Doesn't he play a ventriloquist? So.
Yes, it was a remake of The Unholy Three that he made in 1925 as Echo the ventriloquist and the gangster. And yes, by the time MGM had decided to pursue talkies also, funny enough, they were one of the last studios to transit, just because they were probably the most dominant studio in all of Hollywood, that they didn't feel the pressure to compete with the burgeoning talkie revolution. So they could afford to take their time, they could release a talkie, but then they could release several silent films and the revenue would still be amazing for the studio, whereas other studios probably had to conform really quick just because they didn't have the star system that MGM shamelessly flaunted. And several Chaney films had been transitioned to sound at this point, all without Chaney. But for Chaney himself, because he himself was the special effect, it was guaranteed to be a winner, even if it had been an original story that isn't as remember today strictly because people get to hear the thing that's been denied them for all this time, which is Cheney's voice.
Yeah.
And he would have transitioned very easily to talkies because he had a very rich, deep voice, which coming from theatre, he had to have had in terms of doing dialogue. He wasn't someone like a lot of younger actors who had started out predominantly in feature films who could only pantomime lines. Cheney actually knew how to deliver dialogue, so it did feel natural and it didn't feel read off the page. And he does about five voices in The Unholy Three, so MGM was truly trying to market his voice for everything that they could as Mrs. O'Grady. In his natural voice, he imitates a parrot and a girl. And yeah, he really would have flourished in the sound era.
Were there any surprises? It sounds like you've been researching this for virtually your whole life, but were there any surprises that you came across as you really dug in about the film?
With regards to London After Midnight, the main surprise was undoubtedly probably the star chapter of the whole thing, which is the nitrate framed from an actual destroyed print of the film itself, which sounds crazy to even being able to say it. But yeah, the nitrate frames themselves presented a quandary of questions that just sent me into a whole nother research mode, trying to find out where these impossible images came from, who they belonged to, why they even existed, why they specifically existed. Because looking for something that you know you're told doesn't exist, and then to find it, you kind of think someone is watching over you planting this stuff as though it's the ultimate tease. To find a foreign movie poster for London After Midnight would be one thing, but to find actual pieces of the lost film itself, it was certainly the most out-of-body experience I've ever had, just to find something that I set out to find, but then you find it and you still can't believe that you've actually found it.
And how did you find it?
I had connections with a few foreign archives who had befriended me and took to my enthusiasm with the silent era and specifically Cheney and all the stars connected to Cheney films. And quite early on, I was told that there were a few photo albums that had various snippets to silent films from Cheney. They didn't really go into what titles these were because they were just all a jumble. All I knew is that they came from Cinefell's widow, and he had acquired prints of the whole films from various, I suppose, junk stores in Spain. But not being a projectionist, he just purely took them at the face value that he'd just taken the images and snipping them up and putting them in photo albums, like how you would just do photographs. And then the rest of the material was sadly discarded by fire. So all we were left with were these snipped relics, survivors almost, to several Cheney lost films. Some of them not lost, but there were films like The Phantom of the Opera in there, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mockery, The Unknown. But then there were several lost films, such as London After Midnight, The Big City, Thunder, and All the Brothers Were Valiant, which are mainly, other than Thunder, are all totally complete lost films. So to find this little treasure trove, it was just finding out what the images meant and connecting them up, trying to put them in some sort of chronological scholarly order. Grueling, but it was very fun at the same time. And because I had identified myself with all of these surviving production stills from the film, a lot of them which formed the basis of the 2002 reconstruction by Turner Classic Movies, it didn't take me too long to identify what scenes these surviving nitrate frames were from. But there were several frames which had sets that I recognized and costumes that I recognized. But in the photographic stills, they don't occupy the same space at the same time. So it's like the two separate elements had crossed over. So that left me with a scholarly question of what I was looking at. I was able to go back and sort of rectify certain wrongs that have been accepted throughout the 60s as being the original, say, opening to London After Midnight. So I've been able to disprove a few things that have made the film, I suppose, a bit more puzzling to audiences. Some audiences didn't really get what the plot was to begin with. So So it was nice to actually put a bit more order to the madness finally.
At what point did you come across the original treatment and the script?
The treatment and the script, they came from a private collector who had bought them at auction a number of years ago, who I was able to thankfully contact, and they still had the two documents in question. I had learned through Philip J. Reilly's previous books on London After Midnight that he had the two latter drafts of the script, the second edition and the third draft edition. And again, the question of why and where, I just always wondered where that first draft of the script was, hoping it would contain new scenes and open new questions for me and to study. And once I managed to find those two documents, they did present a lot of new perspectives and material that added to the fuller plot of the original hypnotist scenario, as opposed to the shortened, time-efficient London After Midnight film that was ultimately delivered to audiences. So again, it helped to put a little bit more order to the madness.
You found an actual piece of the film that you were able to, somebody got images from it? Is that what we're, and then you found the scripts, but the images are terrific and they're all in your book. They came from what exactly?
The just below 20 images of the film came from originally a distribution print, a Spanish distribution print from about 1928 originally. They were on 35 millimeter, indicating that they were from the studio. And as is with a lot of silent films that have been found in foreign archives, normally when a film is done with its distribution, it would have to be returned to the original studio to be destroyed, except for the original negative and a studio print, because there is no reason why a studio would need to keep the thousands of prints when they have the pristine copy in their vault. But a lot of smaller theatre cases, in order to save money on the postage or the shipping, they would just basically declare that they had destroyed the film on the studio's behalf. There is no record system with this stuff. And that's how a lot of these films ended up in the basements of old theatres, which eventually, when they closed, the assets were sold off to collectors or travelling showmen. And eventually, these films found their ways into archives or, again, private collections, some of which people know what they have. A lot of times, they don't know what they have because they're more obsessed with, naturally more dedicated to preserving the films of their own culture that was shown at the time, as opposed to a foreign American title, which they probably assume they already have a copy of. But it's how a lot of these films get found. And with the London After Midnight example, there were the images that I found spanned the entire seven reels, because they came from different points in the film. It wasn't a single strip of film of a particular scene. Having, thankfully, the main source that we have for London After Midnight is the cutting continuity, which is the actual film edited down shot for shot, length for length. And it describes briefly, although descriptive enough, what is actually in each and every single shot of the film. And comparing the single frame images from the film with this document, I was able to identify at what point these frames came from during the film, which again spanned the entire seven reels, indicating that a complete seven reel version of the film had gotten out under the studio system at one point. As is the case, I'm assuming, because these came from the same collection, I'm assuming it was the same with the other Lost Chaney films that, again, sadly, only survive in snippet form.
It's like somebody was a collector and his wife said, well, we don't have room for all this. Just take the frames you like and we'll get rid of the rest of it. So you mentioned in passing the 2002 reconstruction that Turner Classic Movies did using the existing stills. I don't know if they were working from any of the scripts or not. That was the version I originally saw when I was working on writing those portions of The Miser's Dream that mention London After Midnight. Based on what you know now, how close is that reconstruction and where do you think they got it right and where did they get it wrong?
The 2002 reconstruction, while a very commendable production, it does stray from the original edited film script. Again, the problem that they clearly faced on that production is that there were not enough photographed scenes to convey all the photographed scenes from the film. So what they eventually fell into the trap of doing was having to reuse the same photograph to sometimes convey two separate scenes, sometimes flipping the image to appear on the opposite side of the camera. And because of a certain lack of stills in certain scene cases, they had to rewrite them, and sometimes a visual scene had to have been replaced with an intertitle card merely describing what had happened or describing a certain period in time, as opposed to showing a photograph of what we're meant to be seeing as opposed to just reading. So they did the best with what they had. But since then, there have been several more images crop up in private collections or in the archives. So unless a version of the film gets found, it's certainly an endeavor that could be revisited, I think, and either do a new visual reconstruction of sorts or attempt some sort of remake of the film even.
That's an idea.
You certainly have the materials to do that. Yeah. I've got an odd question. There's one famous image, a still image, from the film showing Chaney as Professor Burke, and he's reaching out to the man in the beaver hat whose back is to us. Is that a promo photo? Spoiler alert, Burke is playing the vampire in the movie. He admits that that's him. So he never would have met the character. What is the story behind that photo?
There are actually three photographs depicting that those characters that you described. There are the two photographs which show Chaney in the Balfour Mansion, seemingly directing a cloaked, top-hatted figure with long hair with its back towards us. And then there is another photograph of Chaney in the Man in the Beaver Hat disguise with a seemingly twin right beside him outside of a door. Basically, the scenes in the film in which Chaney appear to the Hamlin residents, the people who are being preyed upon by the alleged vampires, the scenes where the Chaney and the vampire need to coexist in the same space or either appear to be in the same vicinity to affect other characters while at the same time interrogating others, Chaney's character of Burke employs a series of assistants to either dress up as vampires or at certain times dress up as his version of the vampire to parade around and pretend that they are the man in the beaver hat. Those particular shots, though, the vampire is always photographed from behind rather than the front. The very famous scene, which was the scene that first got me interested in London After Midnight, in which the maid, played by Polly Moran, is in the chair shrieking at Chaney's winged self, hovering over her. It was unfortunate to me to realize that that was actually a flashback scene told from the maid's perspective. And by the end of the film, the maid is revealed to be an informant of Burke, a secret detective also. So it's really a strong suspension of disbelief has to be employed, because the whole scene of Chaney chasing the maid through the house and appearing under the door, that was clearly just the MGM's marketing at work just to show Chaney off in a bizarre makeup with a fantastic costume, whereas he is predominantly the detective, and the scenes where he's not needed to hypnotize a character in the full vampire makeup, he just employs an assistant who parades around in the house as him all the times with his back turned so that the audience can't latch on as to who the character actually is, because it must have posed quite a fun confusion that how can Chaney be the detective in this room where the maid has just ran from the vampire, which is also Chaney.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that the plot is fairly convoluted anyway, and then you add that layer. So do you think we'll ever see a copy of it? Do you think it's in a basement somewhere?
I've always personally believed that the film does exist, not personally out of just a unfounded fanboy wish, but just based on the evidence and examples of other films that have been found throughout time. Metropolis being probably the most prominent case. But at one point, there was nothing on London After Midnight, and now there is just short of 20 frames for the film. So if that can exist currently now in the year 2023, what makes us think that more footage can't be found by, say, 2030? I think with fans, there's such a high expectation that if it's not found in their own lifetime or in their own convenient space of time, it must not exist. There's still a lot of silent lost treasures that just have not been found at all. They do exist, though. So with London After Midnight, from a purely realistic standpoint, I've always theorized myself that the film probably does exist in an archive somewhere, but it would probably be a very abridged, foreign, condensed version, as opposed to a pristine 35mm print that someone had ripped to safety stock because they knew in the future the film would become the most coveted of all lost films. So I do believe it does exist. The whole theory of it existing in a private collection and someone's waiting to claim the newfound copyright on it, I think after December of last year, I think it's finally put that theory to rest. I don't think a collector consciously knows they have a copy of it. So I think it's lost until found, personally, but probably within an archive.
Lost until found. That's a great title for a book. I like that a lot. What do you think of the remake, Mark of the Vampire? And in your opinion, what does it tell us about London After Midnight?
Well, Mark of the Vampire came about, again, part of the sound revolution. It was one of those, because it was Chaney and Todd Browning's most successful film for the studio, and Browning was currently being held on a tight leash by MGM because of his shocking disaster film Freaks. I suppose they were a little bit nervous about giving him the reins to do what he wanted again. So looking through their backlog of smash silent hits, London After Midnight seemed the most logical choice to remake, just simply because it was their most successful collaboration. Had it been the Unholy Three, I'm sure... Oh no, we already had the Unholy Three. But had it been another Browning-Chaney collaboration, it might have been the unknown otherwise. So I suppose that's why London After Midnight was selected and eventually turned into Mark of the Vampire. The story does not stray too much from London After Midnight, although they seem to complicate it a little bit more by taking the Burke vampire character and turning it this time into three characters played by three different actors, all of which happen to be in cahoot with one another in trying to solve an old murder mystery. It's very atmospherical. You can definitely tell it's got Todd Browning's signature on it. It's more pondering with this one why they just did not opt to make a legit supernatural film rather than go in the pseudo-vampire arena that they pursued in 1927, where audiences had by now become accustomed to the supernatural with Dracula and Frankenstein in 1931, which no longer relied on a detective trying to find out a certain mystery and has to disguise themselves as a monster. The monster was actually now a real thing in the movies.
Yeah.
So I think if Bela Lugosi had been given the chance to have played a real Count Mora as a real vampire, I think it would have been slightly better received as opposed to a dated approach that was clearly now not the fashionable thing to do. But I suppose, again, because Browning was treading a very thin line with MGM, I suppose he couldn't really stray too far from the original source material. But I find it a very atmospherical film, although I think the story works better as a silent film than it does as a sound film, because there's a lot of silent scenes in that film, away from owls hooting and armadillos scurrying about and winds. But I do think, based on things like The Cat and the Canary from 1927 and The Last Warning, I just think that detective sleuth with horror overtones serves better to the silent world than it does the sound world, away from the legit supernatural.
So if Chaney hadn't died, do you think he would have played Dracula? Do you think he would have been in Freaks? Would Freaks have been more normalized because it had a big name in it like that?
It would have been interesting if Chaney had played in Freaks. I think because Todd Browning used the kinds of individuals that he used for Freaks, maybe Chaney would have, for a change, have been the most out of place. I do think he might have played Dracula. I think Universal would have had a hell of a time trying to get him over because he had just signed a new contract with MGM, whereas Todd Browning had transferred over to Universal by 1930 and really wanted to make Dracula for many years and probably discussed it with Chaney as far back as 1920. But certainly MGM would not have permitted Chaney to have gone over to Universal, even for a temporary period, without probably demanding a large piece of the action in a financial sense, because Universal had acquired the rights to Dracula at this point. And based on the stage play that had come out on Broadway, it was probably assured that it was going to be a giant moneymaker based on the success of the Dracula play. But because of Chaney's status as a, I suppose retrospectively now as a horror actor, he was probably the first person to be considered for that role by Carl Laemmle Sr. and Jr. for that matter. And Chaney gone by 1930, it did pose a puzzle as to who could take over these kinds of roles. Chaney was probably the only one to really successfully do it and make the monster an actual box office ingredient more than any other actor at that time, as he did with Phantom, Blind Bargain, London After Midnight. So I think to have pursued Chaney for a legit supernatural film would have had enormous possibilities for Browning and Chaney himself. You can kind of see a trend, a trilogy forming with Browning from London After Midnight, in which he incorporates things he used in Dracula in London After Midnight, so he kind of had this imagery quite early on. So to go from, despite it's not in that order, but to have London After Midnight, Mark of the Vampire, and he also did Dracula, he clearly was obsessed with the story. And I think Chaney was probably the best actor for someone like Browning, who complemented his way of thinking and approach to things like silence, as opposed to needing dialogue all the time, loud commotions. So I think they dovetailed each other quite well, and that's why their 10-year director-actor relationship was as groundbreaking as it was.
If the film does surface, if we find the film, what do you think people, how are they going to react to the movie when they see it? What do you think? What's going to be the reaction if it does surface?
Well, the lore of London After Midnight, the power in the film is its lost status rather than its widespread availability. I think it could never live up to the expectation that we've built up in our heads over the past 40 to 60 years. It was truly people, fans like Forrest J. Ackerman, that introduced and reignited the interest in Chaney's career. By the late 50s and 1960s, that's when London After Midnight started to make the rounds in rumour, the rumours of a potential print existing, despite the film had not long been destroyed at that point. So it was always a big mystery. There were always people who wanted to see the film, but with no access to home video or etc., the only way you could probably see the film would have been at the studio, who held everything. And by the time the TV was coming out, a lot of silent films didn't make it to TV. So again, it has just germinated in people's heads, probably in a better form than what they actually remembered. But the true reality of London After Midnight is one more closer to the ground than it is in this. People are probably expecting to see something very supernatural on par with Dracula, whereas it's more so a Sherlock Holmes story with mild horror-ish overtones to it, that you can kind of see better examples of later on in Dracula in 1930 and in Mark of the Vampire. It's a film purely, I think, for Lon Chaney fans. For myself, having read everything I can on the film, everything I've seen on the film, I personally love silent detective stories, all with a touch of horror. So I personally would know what I'm going in to see. I'm not going in to see Chaney battling a Van Helsing-like figure and turn to dust at the very end, or turning to a bat. I'm going to see a detective melodrama that happens to have what looks like a vampire, so it certainly couldn't live up to the expectations in people's minds. And it's probably the only film to have had the greatest, cheapest marketing in history, I would think. It's one of those films, if it was discovered, you really would not have to do much marketing to promote it. It's one of those that in every fanzine, magazine, documentary, reference in pop, it has really marketed itself into becoming what I always call the mascot of the genre. But there are other more important lost films that have been lost to us. The main one, again, which has been found in its more completer form, was Metropolis, which is a better movie. But unlike Metropolis, London After Midnight has a lot more famous ingredients to it. It has a very famous director. It has a very famous actor whose process was legendary even during then. And it's actually the only film in which he actually has his makeup case make a cameo appearance by the very end. And it goes on the thing that everyone in every culture loves, which is the vampirism, the dark tales and folklore. So when you say it, it just gets your imagination going. Whereas I think if you're watching it, it's probably you'll be looking over the projector to see if something even better is going to happen. The film had its mixed reactions when it originally came out. People liked it because it gave them that cheap thrill of being a very atmospherical haunted house with the creepy figures of Chaney walking across those dusty hallways. But then the more important story is a murder mystery. It's not Dracula, but it has its own things going for it. I always kind of harken it back to the search for the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot. It has more power in your mind than it does in an aquarium or in a zoo. Hearing someone say that they think they saw something moving around in Loch Ness, but there's no photographic evidence, you just have the oral story, that is much more tangible in a way than actually seeing it in an aquarium where you can take it for granted. And it's the same with London After Midnight. And I think that's why a lot of hoaxers and pranksters tend to say that they have seen London After Midnight more than any other lost film.
For a film that I would say the majority of the world does not have any frame of reference. And I'm using myself as the sort of blueprint for that. No frame of reference for this film. That image is iconic in a way that has been, I mean, it, at first glance, could be Jack the Ripper. I was talking to John before we started the podcast. Once I locked in on that image, then I started to think, the ghosts in Disney's Haunted Mansion. There's a couple of ghosts that have elements of that. I mean, it was so perfectly done, even though we don't, I bet you 9 out of 10 people don't know the title London After Midnight, but I bet you 7 out of 10 people know this image.
Oh, definitely. It has certainly made its mark on pop culture. Again, I think it's a beautiful, simplistic design. Everything from the simplistically cut teeth to the bulging eyes and the very nice top hat as well, which is in itself today considered a very odd accessory for a grotesque vampire character. But it's one of those things that has really carried over. It influenced other movies and artists. It was one of the influences for the Babadook creation for that particular monster. It was an influence on the Black Phone. It's just a perfect frame of reference for movie makers and sculptors and artists to keep taking from.
Yep. It'll live long beyond us. Dan, one last question. I read somewhere or heard somewhere that you're next going to tackle James Whale. Is that correct?
James Whale is a subject, again, I happen to come from the exact same town that he was born and raised in Dudley, England. So it's always been a subject close to home for me, which is quite convenient because I love his movies. So I'm hoping to hopefully, plan a documentary feature on him based on a lot of family material in the surrounding areas that I was able to hunt down and forgotten histories about him and just put it together in some form, hopefully in the future.
That would be fantastic. And we'll have you back at that point.
So let's pretend for a minute that the audience is me and they'd have absolutely no idea who James Whale is or what he's done. Just for a minute, let's pretend they're me.
We'll pretend that you don't know that, okay.
Yeah.
Well, James Whale isn't the most known for his work for directing Frankenstein with Boris Karloff in 1931, but he also directed probably some of the most important horror films that have ever existed in the history of the motion picture, The Old Dark House, which can be cited for its very atmospherical and black comedy tones, The Invisible Man with Claude Rains and Gloria Stewart in 1933, and the most important one, which is probably the grand jewel in the whole of the Universal Monsters Empire, which is Bride of Frankenstein in 1935, which is the ultimate example of everything that he had studied, everything that he'd learned with regards to cinema and comedy, life and death, and just making a very delicious cocktail of a movie in all of its black comedy, horrific forms that we're still asking questions about today. One of his first films that he did was for Howard Hughes on Hell's Angels, in which, because he's coming over from theatre, when again films in America were taken off with the sound revolution, they all of a sudden needed British directors to translate English dialogue better than the actors could convey. So James Whale was one of many to be taken over to America when he had a hit play called Journey's End, which became the most successful war play at that point. And he did his own film adaptation of Journey's End. He also did a really remarkable film called Showboat, which is another very iconic film. And again, someone with James Whale's horror credentials, you just think, how could someone who directed Frankenstein directed Showboat? But clearly a very, very talented director who clearly could not be pigeonholed at the time as a strictly horror director, despite it is the horror films in which he is remembered for, understandably so, just because they contain his very individualistic wit and humor and his outlooks on life and politics. And being an openly gay director at the time, he really was a force unto himself. He was a very modern man even then.
Thanks to Daniel Titley for chatting with me and my occasional co-host, Jim Cunningham. You can find a link to Daniel's terrific book on London After Midnight in the show notes. Did you enjoy this interview? You can find lots more just like it on the Fast Cheap Movie Thoughts blog. Check out the link also in the show notes. Plus, more interviews can be found in my books, Fast, Cheap, and Under Control, Lessons Learned from the Greatest Low-Budget Movies of All Time, and its companion book of interviews with screenwriters called Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way. Both books can be found on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. And while you're there, check out my mystery series of novels about magician Eli Marks and the scrapes he gets into. The entire series, starting with The Ambitious Card, can be found in paperback, hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats. And if you haven't done it already, check out the podcast companion to the books, Behind the Page, the Eli Marks Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Well, that's it for episode 120 of the Occasional Film Podcast, which was produced at Grass Lake Studios. Original music composed and performed by Andy Morantz. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you occasionally.